Rabbit Hole, your favorite Bitcoin podcast.
But I don't want to go among mad people.
Oh, you can't help that. Most everyone's mad here.
All right, we are live. We are now back with, I'm joined today by Nadav Cohen, and I'm going to take a second to give him a shout out because he actually is the first guest to reappear on the podcast, and he's the first person to actually reach out and ask to come on the show. So I wanted to thank him. That's really cool. I'm glad that there's actually, you know, you feel like you can reach out to me because anyone can. You know, if you, this is the message for anybody out there. If you're listening and you want to come on the show, you're working in the Bitcoin space, you want to talk about something, dude, my DMs are open anytime and you can come on. So now looking at the price of Bitcoin, according to bitbo.io, the price is $32,349. And now, what up, Nadav?
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey, I'm glad you're back. So, if you caught our first conversation with our boy Ben, Nadav and I spoke about DLCs and oracles and, you know, everything you guys are working on at SuredBits. So let's just start there and, you know, tell us what you've been up to lately.
Sure. I personally have been working just a bunch on DLCs, and a lot of that work is getting close to kind of a release of some kind. So here to spread the word on how DLCs are going, but you know, also other things, happy to talk about those as well. I guess also Bitcoin S, the open source library that we're maintaining and building over at SuredBits, is also coming near to a new version release as well that has some cool stuff on it. And everything's just kind of coming together here at the beginning of 2021. And I guess Taproot also got merged recently, so activation debates, I guess, are happening soon.
We weren't planning to talk about Taproot today, but since you mentioned it, so what do you think is going to happen with like activation, and how long do you think it'll actually be before we start to see some like activation movement, you know, with it?
Yeah. I wish I had a better answer for you. I guess. Yeah. I usually delegate to Ben on activation in particular, because he seems to have his finger on the pulse more than I do. I kind of just wait for things to happen. I'd really love it if it was in by end of year, and I've heard lots of people say that that's very possible, so I'm excited about that. I think there's still not general consensus about how we're gonna do activation, though it sounds like it's at least somewhat narrowed down to, like, you know, I mean, maybe it was always somewhat narrowed down to a couple mechanisms, but because it's not a contentious change, at least we don't see any reason why it should be, or haven't heard anyone, you know, mention any reason why it shouldn't be, at least yet. The hope, and I mean, there's also been like public support from various miners and mining pools. I'm hoping that it is very possible to get in by end of year. That would be really great, because it also kind of works out timing wise well with kind of the DLC project. I'd love it if V1 DLC release in the future was kind of Taproot enabled. But
What does the V1 look like for DLCs?
So V0 is the thing we're almost done with. And so I was jokingly saying, like, it would be great if Taproot came out right after so we could get to work on that. But V1, I have no clue what'll be in there, but I can talk about what will be in V0.
Let's start at V0.
So it kind of will contain kind of the base level, you know, what you want out of DLC functionality with some bells and whistles, but not too many. You know, we had to cut scope a decent amount compared to like what we know is possible. So, but there's still going to be a lot of stuff in here. We've got, and so some of the stuff I will say is subject to change tomorrow at the spec meeting, or I guess in 2 days, there's going to be a spec meeting. And we're going to go over this. I just published this milestone recently, but I believe what will be in it. And some of this stuff is for sure. So we have kind of full support for just like your basic DLCs where it's like multiple choice or enumerated outcomes, as we call them. So say, you know, you want to have a Bitcoin contract whose payouts are contingent on some real world event that has some finite set of outcomes that you can just list. So say like, you know, a sporting event usually has just like a finite list of outcomes. Or, you know, an election is what was more relevant recently with all of the DLCs that were executed around the US elections. Those just had two outcomes, right? So full support for kind of enumerated outcomes. And then also we are supporting numeric outcomes, which, I mean, in theory, you know, you can think of those. There's a finite number of possibilities. It's any number between like 1 in a million or something like that. Say if you're talking about the BTC price in whatever amount of time. But it's not really practical to have a million different outcomes. And so we have developed a bunch of cool tricks that compress this down to just a couple thousand outcomes before executing, which we can talk about more, but just at a high level, we have full support for kind of numeric outcomes with whatever kinds of payout curves you want to draw up. This is going to be super useful and cool for like any kind of, you know, financial contract you want, you know, call options, these kinds of things, CFDs, as I'm sure we'll get into, contracts for difference. So that'll be in there. We've also, somewhat recently, both discovered how we're going to do this and decided to include it in V0 is multi-oracle support. So now, rather than just relying on a single oracle, you can choose some threshold T of N oracles, say like 2 of 3 oracles or 3 of 5 oracles. And for numeric outcomes, this even supports where they disagree within bounds. So you specify what those bounds are. But say, you know, you have an oracle from Coinbase saying what the BTC USD price is, an oracle from Kraken, an oracle from Gemini, and you're doing like a 2 of 3. So long as two of them are like close enough together where you decide what close enough is, say like within $128 or something like that, then you can execute on those two. So all of that stuff is... Well, I guess the specification stuff is going through review, but it's basically done in functional. And there's even an implementation of it that I made in Bitcoin S. So all of that stuff will be in there. And then there's a bunch of kind of smaller things, tidying stuff up, making sure that we do as good for privacy as is practical without an undue amount of work. So like randomizing the orders of inputs and outputs, these kinds of things. And yeah, I mean, I guess, the other, I guess two things coming out with this, release, I don't know if it's best called a release. Maybe it's just like a version milestone or something. It's essentially us saying that the DLC spec, although it's still going to continue changing, kind of like how the bolts for Lightning are always changing, but it is usable and out in the wild. So I guess once this milestone or release happens, that's kind of us saying like, okay, we think that it's ready for some initial, you know, experimentation. We're going live, so to speak. So the other two things are we kind of want to get the Oracle interface as stable as possible because it's really hard to change the Oracle interface after the fact. You know, someone, if we release this tomorrow, they could, you know, broadcast that they're going to be signing some event that happens in like 10 years. Like, what's the Bitcoin price in 10 years? And, you know, if we between now and 10 years from now want to change how it is that oracles communicate, that leads to some complications. I mean, it's solvable. It's just a pain in the butt to deal with. And so we're, our goal here with V0 is to have a super stable Oracle interface so that oracles will more or less be done at least in the sense that maybe we add more things, but we don't change existing things. So kind of forwards compatibility. And then the last thing is we'll even have support for, I've been calling them disjoint union DLCs. That's probably too technical a name. We'll think of something nicer at the spec meeting, I hope. But essentially,
what does that mean?
Yeah. So the idea is, so union, by union, I mean or. So you have like two different contracts, essentially, that you're putting together into one. And disjoint means that these two contracts are talking about entirely different things. So this is essentially like an or contract where, say, I guess the most pertinent example that is why these came up is, say, you have like a call option where either you execute, say, in a month at whatever the price is then, or if the price drops below a certain number at any time before then a liquidation happens and you can execute immediately, well before a month from now. And the other party just gets all of the collateral, say. So this is a situation where you have like one event, which is what is the price in a month? And then you have a different event, which is does the price ever break this threshold? And then you kind of put these together so that you can execute on either of these two contracts, essentially. So it's a union of two disjoint contracts, so to speak. So that stuff, at least I can tentatively say that will also be included in this release.
How does the disjoint union contract work with multi oracles?
That's a good question. And since I kind of proposed disjoint union DLCs, I mean, it's been an idea for quite a while, but I've proposed they be added to this milestone after a couple discussions. We still haven't solidified details, but I guess I can say how they could work, because I have some ideas.
Right. How could they work?
Yeah. So essentially, with a disjoint union DLC, you're kind of taking two contract infos and just building all of the transactions to execute on each contract separately, but off of the same funding transaction. So it's as if you're doing a normal DLC setup for one of the contracts, but when you're done, signing all of the off-chain transactions before you've signed the funding transaction, you kind of rewind and then continue setup as if you're doing this other contract. And so you kind of set up all the possible executions off of your funding transaction for both contracts. So essentially, you can do this in a way where you just treat it like a normal multi-oracle. So I guess oracles are specified in a given contract info. And right, so these, since they're two disjoint events, they have different oracles already. So they just have different oracle infos during contract negotiation, which is the time where you like specify what the oracles are and all these kinds of things. And so you kind of just run it through as if you're doing a normal multi-oracle DLC, but you just do it twice for a single funding transaction, is my best guess for how this is going to go. So essentially you have a disjoint union where the things you're putting together, these contracts, include their lists of oracles. So they have different oracles, and they can both use multiple different oracles. With some threshold as well. All of this stuff is super interoperable, for sure. You can do disjoint union, multi-oracle, numeric DLCs, which is actually something I expect to happen. And I know that there are some people interested in making some applications on top of that very thing, specifically call options.
Yeah, so it seems like a lot of this is around speculating on price at a specific point in time in the future. Mm. So what are some other applications that could, be built with DLCs, that may relate to price? Like something that comes to my mind is like, could you basically, so I just joined the team at Swan Bitcoin And could you potentially do something with Swan in a DLC that says, like, you can't, like, a family member can't spend this Bitcoin before the price is $100,000?
let me think. That sounds possible. Yeah. Yeah, I guess there.
You can almost lock yourself into a longer time preference. Is what I'm trying to say. Is like force yourself into a DLC where you can't sell before 500K.
Totally. Yes. So I guess at a high level, this is totally possible. Now the current specification, just as it stands, specifies how you build kind of the funding transaction to a T, kind of, you know, in this nice deterministic way. And in order to do this, you'd have to make a couple modifications, right? Because presumably when you say that a family member can only spend this once you hit 100K, do you mean that you can spend it whenever and they can spend it only after that price? Or do you mean that like these funds are locked up until 100K?
I don't know. I think I meant these funds are locked up completely. Like I can't either. Like,
yes, or that,
both.
That's much
easier. What would be the answer to both?
Yeah. So, okay, yeah. It's just that the funds are locked up, and then once it hits 100K, then you know, they can spend it. Then that is certainly easier to set up, because you just essentially set up a DLC with them. You know, you provide all the funds, and then you know, you use a price threshold oracle that broadcast a signature when you break 100K, and then when that happens, then the funds get sent. I guess it's not exactly it's unlocked in a sense, but the funds would then get sent to an address that's owned by this family member. And then I guess you could, if you wanted, you know, the specification allows for it, you could have a refund transaction where if at a certain time, say like 10 years from now, you know, choose a date, or choose a block height, choose whatever. If by that time the price has not yet breached 100K, then you can have some fail safe so that the funds just aren't locked up forever. You know, you can immediately send it back into a new DLC if you want it, but maybe you don't want to lock the funds up forever until this oracle says something. Especially, I mean, it's probably a good idea to have the refund just in case, you know, the oracle disappears, or the oracles that you're using disappear and never broadcast a signature, then maybe you want to, you know, update your contract terms or something like this. Yeah. And I guess I should say, though, if this is just a DLC on chain before it's been executed is a 2 of 2 multisig, kind of similar to a Lightning channel. And so it does have the property that, you know, if you need to, you and your counterparty can agree to do something that has nothing to do with what any oracle said, right? So if you decide like, oh, it's been too long, you know, you trust this family member, then you guys can go through a kind of cooperative settlement, so to speak. This isn't in the specification in any way yet, but, you know, you can just use PSBTs or whatever else to just spend your 2 of 2 into whatever you want. So anyway, I guess all of that to say, probably want to build in some fail safes, but you can totally just lock up the funds, and that's all kind of doable under the current specification, assuming both you and your family member have a DLC enabled wallet or a DLC enabled application that you put your funds into. Yeah. So the other way where you kind of, it's just like you're adding a condition to essentially like an output, say, where, you know, you can spend whenever, but a family member can only spend, you know, if the price hits a certain range. This is also totally doable. It is a little bit like, it's not a ton more complicated. There's a couple extra steps, though, that aren't in the current specification that you might have to do custom, so to speak, where... Yeah, there are a couple different ways you could do this. Maybe you could even do it with the current specification by hacking it in, or you do like a disjoint union DLC where one of the events is like, you are the only oracle and you can broadcast a, you know, a dumb, like, you know, trivial signature and use that to unlock the funds where they all get sent to you or something like that. So I guess that would be the easy way of doing it under the current specification, as it will be, is you just do a disjoint union DLC where one of the events is that your family member gets it after 100K, and the other event kind of in this union is you say so and you get it. or you could even have different outcomes where, like, you say so and you get this much and your family member gets this much, where you get to decide kind of how that pans out, since you're the oracle.
So what is this going to look like in the future to the average person? Because right now if you're not decently technical, or you're not familiar with what these things are outside of this conversation, you're probably having a hard time following.
Sure.
So what is, I guess what I'm trying to say, like, what is this going to look like? And then why should the average person be interested in, you know, the work that you're doing?
Yeah. So I guess I have two different answers from two different angles to that. One of them is that, at the end of the day, you don't have to deal with the specification. You don't have to deal with kind of like how Lightning works, right? Like, I would venture a guess and say that most Lightning users have not read the bolts. They haven't had to. They don't really need to know too much about the technical details about how Lightning works, how HTLCs enable routing, all these kinds of things. At the end of the day, they just have like an application, you know, be it on their phone or on their computer or elsewhere, on their Raspberry Pi even, which runs and like gives them access to some set of functionality. In the case of Lightning, you know, very fast, very cheap payments in Bitcoin collateral. So DLCs enable kind of arbitrary Oracle contracts. So essentially, if you want to make a payment that's contingent on some real world events, is what this enables. So, you know, at a high level, going back to kind of use cases, this includes all sorts of, you know, anything betting, essentially, that you want to do, you can do using DLCs, you know, be that, you know, fantasy football, or, you know, who wins an election, or, you know, I guess transitioning what the price is, you know, there's all sorts of financial contracts, but that includes kind of both, you know, your normal speculation, and then also, you know, there's lots of kind of more business, maybe like hedging use cases. One example of which is, you know, synthetic assets, which you can kind of accomplish using DLCs, where, say, you put you put some amount of Bitcoin in collateral into a discrete log contract. And then, you know, in a month or whatever time period you decide, with your counterparty, then these funds get unlocked. But the amount of Bitcoin that you get back is a fixed USD amount. So the same like USD amount as what you put in earlier, regardless of what the Bitcoin price movement has been. So that's called a contract for difference. Essentially, your price exposure is to, or you essentially, it's as if you're holding USD from like a, you know, purchasing power price kind of perspective, but the contract is Bitcoin collateral. So these have various use cases. I mean, you know, if like you're doing business with a company overseas that uses a different currency, then, you know, oftentimes you want to sign a deal with them today in a given contract, and you don't want to care about what price movement is between your two currencies. You want it to just be kind of fixed to when you sign the deal. So you can use a CFD, contract for difference, using DLCs and Bitcoin collateral in this instance. And there are plenty of other uses there, especially, you know, in the future. This won't happen on V0, but someday, you know, we'll have DLCs on Lightning, and then you can have kind of these nice synthetic assets inside of Lightning channels, so that you have like a wallet, kind of like Abra, if you've ever used Abra, but on Lightning, where it's non-custodial, and you can, like, it's as if you have like some dollars and maybe some other currencies and maybe some Bitcoin as well inside of your Lightning channel. But when you're sending it, it's really sending sats, And what's happening under the hood is you have some DLCs inside of your channel that are essentially moving funds back and forth between you and your counterparty to ensure that you have some fixed amount of whatever currency it is that you have. So say if you wanted fixed USD, say the BTC USD price goes up, then you would have to pay a little bit to the other person in order to maintain a fixed USD, because otherwise you would have more USD than you had before. But if the price goes down, then they pay you. So either way, you have a fixed USD amount and your counterparty is basically going long BTC. So that's what a DLCFD is. And yeah, so there are all kinds of these use cases that we already know about more or less and know that they're going to be developed. I'm also pretty confident that people will find lots of use cases for DLCs, you know, that aren't already, you know, on my radar. And this kind of gets into my second angle, which is DLCs can also be thought of as just kind of like a building block technology, similar to like, you know, HTLCs have various uses, including but not limited to like just enabling routing on the Lightning Network. You can also do things like coin swaps and atomic swaps using HTLCs, and just a lot of different things you might want to do on top of Bitcoin use kind of that that mechanism as a building block to build more interesting things. And likewise, so I mean, an HTLC is actually itself a combination of two building blocks. It's a hash lock and a time lock. So it's a hash time lock contract, HTLC. So a DLC is like a new kind of lock for Bitcoin contracts, which is an oracle lock, where, you know, in some sense, an oracle lock is a bit more expressive than, say, like a hash lock or a time lock, where those things are kind of like binary, you know, either the time is reached and this happens or it isn't and this happens. Whereas with an oracle lock, it's like either an oracle says this or this or this or this or this, right? There's a bunch of different things that could happen. But at the end, you know, it's just another primitive for Bitcoin contracting, for like what you can do on top of Bitcoin that I think, you know, will be integrated with other things. Kind of like I mentioned, you know, this is going to be integrated into Lightning channels, I think, in the future to enable things like synthetic assets, which is kind of this emergent thing on top of both Lightning and DLCs. And I think that there are going to be other use cases for this kind of stuff as well. For example, I had not thought about the use case of like your you know, family member can only access these funds after the price hits 100K. But you would certainly need something like DLCs in order to execute something like that, or in order to build a contract like that. So I think we'll see a lot of use cases kind of pop up that use DLCs just because they didn't exist previously. So people weren't trying to build these kinds of things.
Right. Like the example that I just gave you, like, to me, that's almost like a synthetic will in a way. It's, you know, it's something different made up from these building blocks. And it is curious. It is interesting to, you know, think or, you know, sort of imagine what other people could come up with, you know, that you could potentially build with this. So it's like, how does it relate to other financial assets? Like, you could potentially be speculating now on a derivative of a derivative and then getting paid in Bitcoin out of it. Like, totally. You could potentially be speculating on GME in an Oracle contract.
Exactly.
Or DLC, yeah.
Yeah, and anything that you have an Oracle for, any number, any event, you can build, you know, Bitcoin collateralized, more or less derivatives around these things, contracts. That execute based on what the price is at a future date, or if the price crosses a certain threshold, all these kinds of things. I totally think in the future there will be, you know, stock price oracles. You'll be able to have a DLC that executes on GME stock if you want to. All sorts of things. It's not just for the BTC USD index. That's for sure. But it's a good example because it's on everyone's mind, probably who's listening. But Yeah, no, you can take any number in, you know, and have an oracle that broadcasts what that number is at a future date. Yeah, and it doesn't even have to be financial. You can like do something super obscure. You could be like, how many three-pointers or you could be like, what's the population of whales in the Pacific Ocean? Yeah, I don't know. You'd need an oracle that could credibly attest to that, and that might be harder. So maybe an easier thing that's just obscure is like, I don't know, how many three-pointers does X NBA player score in the next 3 years or something like that? You could have speculation on or contracts written contingent on all sorts of things and combinations of them. Though the more complicated combinations of multiple events aren't all supported in this V0. They will be in the future, hopefully. They're on the to-do list for future versions. But disjoint union DLCs as a combination is the only kind of thing we have right now. So these kind of ores for disjoint events. You can build a contract based on any real world event. And I think this is something that's kind of been missing from the Bitcoin space for quite a while. I think it's something that drives a lot of people to go work on other projects that aren't Bitcoin. Other blockchains, for example, that allow you to do oracles, not necessarily in as nice a way as DLCs. Like I think that the DLC model for oracles is kind of the way to go as far as oracles are concerned.
So let's get into that, because I posted this on Twitter as well, that we were having this conversation. I know we touched on it a bit in our first conversation, but it's probably going to be a recurring thing that keeps coming back. This Chainlink is like, what is the, like, I'm not asking, but people are asking, what is the difference between the Chainlink model and the DLC model for oracles? Let's just get into that, and you can talk shit if you want.
Well, I guess I'm not an expert on Chainlink, so I won't say anything with too much confidence or shit talk or anything. But my understanding from briefly looking at various docs and things like this is that when you're using Chainlink, you are making on-chain like function calls, say, in Ethereum or some other place, where essentially Chainlink is giving you access to some kind of API. In the real world, where an API is just like some endpoint somewhere on the internet that you can hit up with a request and it gives you a response with some data.
All of that is stored on chain in Chainlink's model. Like every single time a function is called, they're recording that event on the blockchain.
I believe so. I believe that, when your contract is...
That sounds like a logistical nightmare. Like they're having just a mass amount of data being stored on chain. And then
data only hits the chain, I think, when it's requested. I don't think it's like they're preemptively putting all the data on chain. But yes, when users are making calls for data, I believe that does happen on chain. Which, you can talk about like where we are now versus if you wanted to scale this. And I think that your reaction isn't wrong if you're thinking about in the future where like you just assume like all the data is being queried all the time, right?
That's what I was thinking, right? Yeah. Like when you try to scale this on a long period of time, like it's not even going to be able to like function.
Yeah. So I think one of the benefits of DLCs and kind of one of the motivating things for it, if you read the white paper, this is like, in the abstract, it's in the introduction, is not only are DLCs private, but because they're private, or not because they're private, but along with being private, these things are kind of interconnected. It's also kind of a scalable way of working, where what you put on chain is very minimal. Nothing to do with the oracle actually ends up on chain. It's just normal activity. In the future, this stuff can also go off chain. You can think about like, if it's not private, if it's not scalable, it's oftentimes because you're, using the chain too much, which usually means you're also not very private. Like people can see that you're making oracle calls and things like this. that's kind of a big difference. Another kind of difference that's kind of baked into this, I think. So this I'm slightly less confident about, but I know that a lot of Oracle schemes that are out there on other blockchains do have this. I'm not sure if Chainlink is one of them, though I believe it probably would be. That is that you have, when you're writing, like, say, a smart contract, right, you're kind of like hard coding into it oftentimes what your oracles are, so to speak. And so then if anyone wants to use whatever platform it is you've built on top of some oracles, then they're kind of committed to using your chosen oracles. And these oracles know that, like, they can see that in your contract on chain. And then they can see the user's activity and all of this kind of stuff. So it's kind of this place where you're dealing with maybe, you know, in the best case, a federation of oracles, where the oracles that they're like tied to whatever application or platform it is that you've built. So, like, as an example, I believe Maker has like these 17 price oracles that it uses in some way to determine what the price is. But it's always those actors. Like, it's not, it doesn't, it's baked into the platform, so to speak. Whereas with discrete log contracts, so I guess I should say, how do discrete log contracts avoid this? Well, first of all, when you are building a discrete log contract, that's between you and your counterparty. It happens entirely off chain, and you get to pick your oracles. It's not like you're fixed to some federation of oracles. You get to kind of pick your own federation for every contract. So you choose the oracles that you trust. You know, you choose some 3 of 5, 2 of 3, whatever, for your contract. You and your counterparty agree on those, and then that's what you use. And then none of that touches the blockchain. The only thing that happens on chain is the transfer of funds. And so there are two transfer of funds that are associated with a discrete log contract. One of them is locking up funds. So that's where both people post their collateral. That'll be one transaction. And then the second transaction is, you know, execution of the contract, where a payout happens and all the parties get some amount of the locked up funds, depending on what the oracle said. Now, what the oracle said is not traced to the blockchain. Like, you cannot see it there. That all happens off chain. And then the only thing that you can actually see on chain is just kind of normal financial activity, you know, two parties putting funds into one output, and then that one output being spent by two parties later on. You could argue that it's not as private as it could be right now, because you still have this kind of 2 of 2 on chain, which, you know, a lot of people
That's Taproot, though, right? Well, yes. So once we have Taproot, then this is
literally so just a bunch of single pub keys spending to each other. You know, it could be like a consolidation TX followed by a payment that has a change output, right? Like, it looks the same as a DLC. So yeah, in the future, the on-chain footprint will be essentially nothing. Right now, it looks kind of similar to a Lightning channel, to be honest, right? The on-chain footprint of a Lightning channel in the cooperative closing case is that, you know, both parties, or I guess right now it's only one party, but once we have dual funded Lightning channels, it'll be both parties posting collateral into some 2 of 2. And then sometime in the future, they close out with kind of the entire tab, like the aggregate of all the payments that have gone back and forth, and then an output that goes out, or I guess a transaction with two outputs that go out to each party. So it's very similar to that. And, you know, just like that, you know, nobody can look at that and trace all the Lightning payments that happened in that channel just from looking on chain. Likewise with a DLC, you can't see what oracle was used. You can't see how the oracle was used. If there's multiple oracles, you don't know that. If there's a disjoint union DLC, you don't know that. Like, nothing hits the blockchain except for the actual price or the actual Bitcoin that's moving around. So posting collateral and then it being paid out to the parties. That's super interesting
to think about what this is going to look like, and just the sheer nominal amount of money that is going to be disguised in the blockchain. That is because all of these events are recorded off chain, mm-hmm. and then Taproot disguises. So, like, a normal Bitcoin transaction is going to be indistinguishable from this entire black market for derivatives.
Yeah, and hopefully also some non-black market. But
I mean black market, like,
right,
yes, exactly.
Yeah, and not only that, but also, you know, lightning channels, so long as they stay cooperative, will look the same. You know, it's kind of, this isn't specific to DLCs in the sense that, like, the point of Taproot is that it makes most contracts on Bitcoin look the same. It makes most of them look like single pub key spends, like normal activity. So it'll kind of, Taproot will have this awesome effect of making DLCs, lightning channels, coin swaps, maybe not coin joins quite yet, because you still have, like, you know, what, like, so many outputs that someone will probably still guess that that's just a coin join. But, yeah. You know, coin joins have their own way of hiding things, right? The point isn't that you look at it and you can't tell it's a coin join. The point is that you look at it and you can't tell whose funds are which.
Yeah, coin join seems like a temporary solution for me. Yeah. I don't know if I'm wrong in thinking this, but it... Doesn't it seem like everything about coin, even though it's not even like really close to being implemented yet, but coin swaps, when we do have them, wouldn't you just completely want to switch over to using coin swaps instead of coin joins at that point?
So I think that there are a couple like trade-offs to consider. So one of the main ones is in a coin join, you could argue that there's more like deniability if, say, there are some funds that, you know, someone else's funds, you know, say you're like some clean actor, you just want privacy, and you go into it and, you know, post some funds, get some funds out of it, and someone involved in your coin join, like, you know, say some government has like flagged those as being like, you know, bad funds or whatever, funds that were used in some crime or something, it's harder to, you know, make the argument that you should be punished for being in that coin join, at least, you know, in the future, hopefully that will be the case. Whereas with a coin swap, it on chain, what it looks like is these dirty funds were just sent to you and now you're using them. So there's kind of this issue of rather than kind of mixing the burden, you're just swapping it. and maybe you aren't aware of what the dirt is on a given set of coins that you're getting. So you're successfully being private in the sense that, like, these coins aren't linked to any of your other UTXOs. I think it accomplishes that probably better than a coin join, which is probably what you're referencing. But then there's this other downside of, like, well, you don't get the property of coin joins where it, like, you know, it hides you in a large group of people where at this point it's just like you and this other person and it looks like they just paid you, right, is what it looks like on chain. Yes. So I think probably both are part of the solution, right? Like, you could imagine doing like coin swapping for coin joined funds or, you know, something like that.
Oh, that's a good idea.
A thing that happens in the future. But yeah, I guess I'm also no expert on this. I know kind of a bit about how the schemes work because I'm interested in kind of the contracting side of Bitcoin. But as far as like how to best keep anonymity and be a part of a large anonymity set and also not get, you know, screwed over by people who are trying to blacklist certain coins, I think coin joins probably still have, you know, a future, even once we have coin swaps. But yeah, I guess that's as much as I know. I'm not saying that they will. I'm saying that I could imagine that being the case because I think that there are a couple. Yeah, I think there are trade-offs to coin swaps. I mean, obviously, one of the nice things about coin swaps is that they're not traceable in the way coin joins are, right? You can't look on chain and be like, oh, that transaction was part of a coin swap because, like, it just looks like a normal transaction, right? It's just two transactions that happen and you don't know that they're related, but they're actually linked off chain by some secret that they shared in their construction. But you can't see any of that on chain because that secret was used to like encrypt some data off chain. So the unencrypted stuff ends up on chain and you don't see anything of what happened there for how coin swaps work. So yeah, I mean, I do think that we'll see a lot of use for coin swaps, especially if at some point post-Taproot, we see kind of there's this proposal or this idea out there for partially blind coin swaps, where you would have like some server, some central server that's just essentially doing coin swaps as a service with a bunch of people. But they don't know who these people are. These people like come in, say over Tor or something, so that they don't know who they are. And then they're doing coin swaps, but the server is doing coin swaps in a way where they don't know like which of their users coin swapped with which of their funds. So it's like you use blind signatures and some other tricks to do.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Swaps where the users can see like what they're pulling out, but they add delays and some other things in such a way that like the server that's executing these coin swaps and presumably being paid small fees for these, so like, you know, monetizing doing coin swaps, they can't actually like trace, oh, you came in with these funds and left with these funds. They can't do that. They're just like, oh, you came in with some funds. I don't know who you are, so I don't know which of these this is. But the person who came in with these funds, I don't know which funds they left with, is kind of a key feature that you would get out of these. Yeah, that requires Schnorr signatures, by the way. I don't think that there's a very... I haven't heard of anyone proposing a practical blind signature for ECDSA signatures. But okay. Yeah, and the Schnorr blind signatures, they have a little... I don't know. They're not the prettiest blind signatures that have ever existed in cryptography, but they work, and you would use them because, right, on-chain, you need on-chain signatures to be blind, is the only time you would use these. But it works, and I have a blog post about this, by the way. I'm not sure how into coin swaps I get, but if you're interested in like the actual like how do blind signatures work, I have a blog post about that. Yeah, but anyway, that's another cool.
That's on the SHRDBits blog, right?
Yeah, SHRDBits.com/blog. I wrote an 8 or 9 part series about all the things you can do with Schnorr signatures. That'll be coming to Bitcoin cum Taproot. Because Taproot introduces Schnorr signatures as a signature scheme that you can use and should use to Bitcoin. So yeah, it's part of that very long blog series. Parts of it are a little bit technical, but I don't think you have to read all of the different parts in order or anything like that. It starts with an intro of like, what are Schnorr signatures? And then the next two blog posts, I did my best. It's like my best attempt at kind of simplifying down, dumbing down the Schnorr security proof. So like the actual security proof for why we know for a fact that under our normal Bitcoin assumptions, Schnorr signatures are a secure signature scheme, which is something we don't have so nice a proof for ECDSA, by the way. But yeah, I there's two blog posts that kind of cover that in as high level terms as I could. So like you don't need a math degree necessarily to read those posts, but maybe I'm not expecting everyone to be able to make their way through at least all of it. But maybe they'll still get pieces of it because, you know, the security of a signature scheme is actually made up of like 3 or 4 different things. So, you know, maybe you'll still get something out of it, even if you're not a very technical reader, but it is a semi-technical post. And then after that, I go into all the different things like, key aggregation and MuSig, kind of what we've been talking about, where all of your 2 of 2s get turned into a single pub key on chain. And then there's a post in there about adapter signatures, which is how DLCs function. They function using adapter signatures. Coin swaps use adapter signatures. Lightning channels will use adapter signatures in place of HTLCs. All of these kinds of things. And all of essentially what that'll mean is that rather than using an HTLC someplace, right, as you would for a coin swap today, or as you would in a Lightning channel today, you'll instead be doing some stuff off chain with adapter signatures.
So what's a 30-second adapter signature? Yeah, totally. Adapter signature for dummies.
Yes.
I don't know what that means. So
how about I explain how a DLC works, and that is essentially as complicated as an adapter signature, and it uses them, so it'll fit nicely. And I think I'm maybe a minute, not 30, but we'll see. Okay. We'll see how fast I can do the elevator pitch at this point. I'm not an elevator pitch, but the elevator explanation of how the entire technology works. So, you know, I'll do my best. But essentially, what
drum
you
roll.
Have, yes, drum roll. So. You and a counterparty agree on terms for your contract with some oracles. Next up, you find your funds for your collateral, and you tell each other about that So you build a funding transaction, which is both of you funding a 2 of 2 output, so shared custody. But before you actually sign this transaction and put those funds into shared custody, you first have a bunch of off-chain transactions, one for every possible event, loosely speaking. Sometimes, as I mentioned, for numeric outcomes, you have event compression so that you can have fewer of these off-chain transactions. But let's talk about something simple. Say it's like an election bet. The two outcomes are Democrat win, Republican win, or other, say, three outcomes. What you do is you construct three off-chain transactions, one with the payouts for Democrat win, presumably one party gets everything, one for Republican win, presumably the other party gets everything, and one for other, say it refunds. So you have these three off-chain these three transactions that spend your funding output, which isn't even on-chain yet, so it's like doubly off-chain here. And then what you do is you want to be able to give your counterparty signatures of these execution transactions, right? These three execution transactions, so that once the funding transaction goes on chain, you don't need each other in order to execute, right? Once everything has been agreed to and everyone has signed, you don't need cooperation. You want to have the blockchain execute this for you. So how you do this? You can't just give them normal signatures, because then the moment the funding transaction goes on chain, they'll pick their favorite outcome and they'll broadcast it, because that's a fully signed transaction. So you don't want to sign it. What you want to do is you want to give them an encrypted signature where it's been encrypted using the Oracle's keys and some other commitments, such that the decryption key can only be calculated using the Oracle signature of a specific event. So essentially, for each possible event, you can compute this encryption key associated with that event using the Oracle's public information, their public cryptographic commitments, like their pub keys. And then using those encryption keys, you can encrypt your signatures. And this is actually not just normal encryption, this is verifiable encryption, meaning all of this happens in such a way that when you give this encrypted signature to your counterparty, they can, without decrypting it, validate the signature as it is, the encrypted version of the signature. They can validate that the decrypted version is a valid ECDSA signature, or a valid Schnorr signature in the case of Schnorr. And then how that works is, once you've received and validated all of these verifiably encrypted signatures, VESs, then you can consider everyone fully committed. You can sign your funding transaction, post your collateral, put that on chain. And then that's all there is to it. Now, once an Oracle broadcasts a signature, that'll give both you and your counterparty exactly one decryption key for one of those three transactions. And then you'll be able to broadcast that on chain, and the others will stay locked up. So that's how a DLC works. A verifiably encrypted signature is also known as an adapter signature. So an adapter signature is just an encrypted signature where you need the decryption key in order to decrypt it, but you don't need it to be decrypted in order to validate it. So you can validate this encrypted signature, and then it'll be turned into a real signature once you add in some secret. Now, it has this extra property where if someone sees both the encrypted and unencrypted versions of the signature, so the adapter signature and the normal completed signature, they can look at the difference between those things and they can compute the encryption secret from that. So for example, if I look on chain, say you executed our DLC with Democrat win as a transaction, which paid out to one of us, I can look at that transaction, see the signature of mine that's on there, compare it to the adapter signature I gave you, and I can compute the Oracle signature from that. So without having to speak to the Oracle, if you already saw the Oracle signature somewhere, then your execution gives me that Oracle signature just from looking on chain. So that's kind of an extra step. That particular piece of information is only important to DLCs because it lets you generate fraud proofs without having to, get the Oracle signature directly. If you've been cheated, you can derive a proof that you've been cheated and show which Oracle it was that lied. So that's useful in its own right, but it's not as integral to like this Oracle lock concept. It's more interesting over in like a coin swap or say in a Lightning channel if you're routing. As you might know, how Lightning channel routing works is each party along the route sets up a contract to the next person. So say if you're the payer, you just like pay forward. And if you're the receiver, you just receive. But if you're someone in between, what you do is you receive a payment that's contingent on revealing a secret. Where today, revealing a secret means give me the pre-image to this hash. And in the future, it'll be give me like the secret to this point. Or in the case of adapter signatures, which is what'll actually happen, it'll be like give me the encryption private key to this encryption public key. What you do for HTLCs, so if it's give me the secret behind this hash, as a routing node, what you do is you go to the next person and you're like, here's the payment, but you can only claim it if you give me the secret to the same hash. And that way I know I'm not going to be footed with the bill, because either that'll time out and I get my money back on both sides. Or if my money ever gets taken, the money I put up to the next person, the only way that happens is if they reveal the hash pre-image to me. And if they reveal the hash pre-image to me, then I can claim my funds on the other side that someone is posting to me. So as a routing node, you only kind of have to have these local guarantees where you're never footed with the bill. You know that if the person in front of you gets their funds, then you get your funds. So you, with PTLCs, this is where point time lock contracts, that's essentially using adapter signatures instead of HTLCs. What you do is you have, to make it simple, so this isn't actually what happens, but just as a simple version, say somebody comes to you and they're like, here's an encrypted, you know, signature that if you can use the decryption key, you can claim these funds. Then you set up the same thing with the person in front of you. And if they can claim their funds, as I mentioned, adapter signatures have this property where if you look at the two signatures, you can learn the secret. So if these funds get claimed, I must learn the secret. And so I can use that secret to claim my funds. So, but the nice thing here is that since all of this stuff happens off-chain, right? These encrypted signatures are off-chain. The only thing on-chain under Taproot in these situations is a single pub key. You don't have to have this like script reveal of an HTLC, even in the non-cooperative case. It looks nicer than that. It looks like a single pub key spent. But anyway, that was at some point I got away from like what are adapter signatures into how are they used. But at the end of the day, I guess to zoom out, an adapter signature is just a verifiably encrypted signature, meaning that it's a way of trading a secret for a
that you don't have to reveal
signature. Exactly.
It's yeah. So you're not revealing that what the like the actual secret itself is encrypted, and then you're just performing a validation of that data without revealing the underlying data.
Yeah, yeah. So it's an encrypted signature where in order to use the decrypted version of the signature, you have to essentially tell the person who gave you the signature, no one else, just the person who gave you the signature, because you need to have the signature, the encrypted one, in order to compute the secret from the completed one. But essentially, if I give you an encrypted signature and you want to use it, then you have to decrypt it, which essentially just means you have to use some secret that you know. And then if you use the completed signature, then I learn the secret. So it's a way of like sign for secret atomic kind of swap thing happening here.
Right.
Where okay. You atomically swap a secret for a signature. And but yeah, as I mentioned, for like DLCs, in the case of DLCs, the secret that you use is one that they don't actually know yet, right? It's the Oracle signature is the secret. And so you make, you know, a transaction for every possible Oracle signature, and then exactly one of them, the secret will be learned, and you can use that to get a valid signature. So that's how it's used in DLCs. But then, as I mentioned on Lightning, it replaces HTLCs, because HTLCs are like a literal in Bitcoin script, like I am paying you for the pre-image to this hash. And now you can do that without actually having an on-chain footprint, just by off-chain giving an encrypted signature, which in order to use it, you have to leak the decryption key. So in other words, it's a PTLC point time lock contract is just like an HTLC, except for the on-chain footprint is like nothing. And everything happens kind of off-chain. And instead of a hash, it's the pre-image to a point. It's the encryption private key to the encryption public key. And that actually lets you do all sorts of cool things because you can like add you can aggregate pub keys and you can't aggregate hashes. So you can do all sorts of cool stuff with that as well.
Okay, so I kind of want to shift gears a little bit. And so what would be like the incentive or not, that's not the right word. What is it look, what do you imagine it looking like the people that are going to be running these essentially Oracle nodes, right? Mm. That's what they'd be an Oracle node. So it seems to me like there could be a case like, is there a relationship with like routing fees on the Lightning Network that you could potentially be earning in a similar way through running an Oracle?
Yeah. So there are a couple different reasons someone might want to be an Oracle. I'll preface by saying, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to say that part. And then I also want to think about like, if so, like who, do you imagine them being like large or like small players? Like, would there be like, would the average person want to run an Oracle similar to maybe something they care about that's happening, you know, with Lightning, or would, you know, yeah. Maybe I'm going a little too deep with like,
I think that's a good question. So to answer the first question of like, what do you get for running an Oracle node? I'll preface my answer by saying, first of all, running an Oracle is actually like super inexpensive, very simple. We've got open source code for it. Ben has a project called Crystal Bull, which is a cute pun, but it's like a keyring, more or less. I mean, it's to be an Oracle, you have some keys. And so in that sense, it has a similar interface to a wallet, but those keys don't hold funds. They just hold your signing keys and you're an Oracle and you sign events. All Oracles do is they like say, I'm going to sign this event, and then they sign it. So the cost to running an Oracle is very, very, very low. And then you don't need much benefit in order to, you know, be incentivized to run one. So there are a couple of ways that I could see Oracles kind of being viable. One of them is that you can pay for Oracle signatures over Lightning and Oracle announcements over Lightning. In other words, Oracles could monetize using Lightning. Lightning has the nice property that the person receiving funds doesn't know who paid them, right? It's onion routed. And so you have these nice private payments. We do want to keep this property that I guess we never want users to directly contact Oracles, because part of the DLC Oracle model is that Oracles are oblivious. They don't know who the users are, even when executions happen off chain, right? We're using adapter signatures. And so you can't actually see any way that they were used, right? We use them to encrypt signatures and, you know, no one sees that stuff on chain. So you do want to make sure that the Oracle stays oblivious, but with Lightning payments for signatures, you can actually, and announcements, I guess, you can have Oracles be kind of privately paid in return for data. And Lightning actually, because of this, they're set up with HTLCs or PTLCs, they have like receipts essentially over the Lightning Network. When you make a payment, you learn a secret if and only if the payment goes through, because, you know, the first hop, the person who's paying, they set up a payment to the next person saying like, reveal this secret in order to claim these funds. And so that secret can act as like a receipt. So you can essentially like send the data, that the Oracle data, over encrypted with that receipt. And then if and only if you pay, you get your Oracle data. So that is one scheme, is monetizing over Lightning. I think that will definitely happen at some point. Early on, we might see just some like good faith Oracles happening, but, you know, longer term, I definitely think monetizing over Lightning makes a lot of sense. And then kind of another thing is if you're profiting in some other way. So say, for example, you're an exchange. You know, the exchanges in the crypto space are already like giving away all of their market data for free, because they want to draw liquidity onto their platforms. So I also very much expect like all exchanges to start being DLC Oracles in the coming years, where they broadcast signatures, not just the data for each trade. like, here's the new price, here's the new price, things like that. So yeah.
Wow. So you're at that point, you're like validating the price of like the authenticity of the price. That's pretty interesting to think
about. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, you're still like trusting the exchange, but most people are already trusting the exchange. And it would be really nice, for example, as opposed to like, I mean, something you know, you could do today is just have someone be an oracle that like parrots, so to speak, or like rebroadcasts the current price as stated by a given exchange, but with, you know, a DLC compatible signature, a Schnorr signature. You know, in the future, I think cutting out that in between and just directly going to the exchange if they're offering a signature, an Oracle signature, especially if it's for free because they're profiting elsewhere off of this on the underlying kind of market, then, you know, that works out well from a trust perspective, which I guess to answer your small player versus large player, like who's going to be an Oracle question, I think undoubtedly many large players will be oracles. I can imagine there being some small players as well. But I guess the key thing to keep in mind here is that when you are setting up a discrete law contract, so you get to pick your own oracles, and you should kind of just pick some set, and how many depends on like how secure you want to be with the trade-off of like how expensive it is to set up from a computational perspective and like how much storage it requires and stuff like that. But say you're using like 3 of 5, you got to pick your like 5 most trustworthy oracles. So if it's just a bunch of like randos, right, on some Oracle Explorer or something like this, you're probably going to pick the big names, or at least most people are. But I could imagine, like, right, as I said, the cost to running an Oracle is very low. So I could imagine, you know, someone just building up a reputation, especially if they're in early on, of being trustworthy. And things like this. And people might still use, you know, that individual person who's just doing it for kicks or doing it because they get monetized over Lightning or whatever other reason. So I guess it's really the question to ask, which correlates with how big of a player are you going to be in order to be an Oracle, is like, how big a reputation or brand can you build around your Oracle in some sense? That said, right, like if... you and another person have a mutual friend, you could imagine using them as one of many oracles, you know, since you both trust this person. So, you know, anyone can be an oracle. Like it's in the future, it'll take like download an app, boom, you're an oracle, right? Like it's not going to be hard to be an oracle. So it's really a question of like, you have to build up that trustworthiness somehow. You know, some people will be staking funds in various ways to show that they're serious, things like that. I mean, yeah, it's really just a question of like, you know, the market for DLCs, who do they pick as their oracles? You know, it's not going to be just one. And I certainly think that there's always going to be room for some small players, right? You're going to not want to centralize all of your trust into just a couple parties as a user. You're not going to want to do that. Yeah, so I think probably something like a power rule applies here or something. Like you want some amount of oracles at all levels of not credibility. You want only credible oracles, but all levels of kind of like size, like, you know, corporations being oracles, individuals being oracles, kind of everything in between.
Okay. So again, I want to pivot a little bit. Sure. So we have what's happening with Tor V3. Mm. Obviously, Tor V3 is a huge component of the Lightning Network, and this all relies, in a way, on Tor V3. So what are the implications? Okay, first of all, actually, I was hoping I haven't done this. I haven't done this yet. I should have done it. I haven't really been totally paying attention to what's happening. I've heard about it. It seems like it's a state, or it seems like it's some sort of an attack on Tor. And that's affecting what's happening on top of on Lightning, which is overall affecting Bitcoin. Mm. And obviously everything we've just talked about for the last hour and 10 minutes relies on this technology. So kind of, could you explain what's happening and then what are the implications of it?
So I am no Tor expert. My very, very high level understanding is that in order to manage something that everyone needs. I think it might be like the list of exit nodes that you're, or edge nodes, barrier nodes that you use to communicate kind of with the rest of the web. I think that there's some amount of like centralization that happens. There's like some group of nodes that has to come to consensus on that list. I think that the list has something to do with exit nodes. I'm not entirely sure about that either, though. And then I think that they just for a very long time, for some reason or another, I guess I don't even know if it was an attack or a bug or what. It might have been an attack, though. They essentially were not able to come to consensus on this list for a very long time. And essentially what that showed as is you couldn't actually reach anyone, despite the fact that they were like online and operational. And so essentially it made it.
Okay, so this affected all routing on Tor, essentially. Like nodes on Tor couldn't communicate with each other, which then overall affected Lightning because of Tor problems with this.
Yeah, so
supposedly only V3, right?
Yeah, it's just V3. As I mentioned, I don't know too much about like Tor specifics. I do know, or I can't explain like why this affects something like Lightning. So, Lightning is, kind of its own protocol in some sense, or it is its own protocol where, parties, are communicating with their neighbors, and some information about channels and states and stuff like that and nodes is gossiped, but, actual like channel things like moving funds happens just between two people that are adjacent to the network. But I think something important to like keep in mind is that all of these things, including something similar, is true for Bitcoin, where we picture these things as network graphs where you have these nodes that are connected to each other. But you have to keep in mind that these connections aren't like me directly speaking to you over the wire, like over a direct channel of any kind. We're really like going through the internet to speak to one another, right? We're using TCP/IP or Tor or whatever. Tor's built on top. But yeah, so we're using TCP/IP. We're going through still, internet service providers, whether they know who we are or not, whether it's encrypted or not. So if you're using Tor, at the end of the day, you still like depend on that as your communication channel between two quote-unquote adjacent parties. Right. So, although we oftentimes view like the Bitcoin network graph or the Lightning network graph as a bunch of nodes connected to each other, we have to keep in mind that those are like virtual connections. Like they're actually connected over, say, Tor or over, IP or something else. If Tor goes down, that means these Lightning nodes can't communicate with one another, and you can't reach this Lightning node because this Lightning node, in order to send them a message, they have a Tor address. You've got to send it to them into Tor. That's why, if Tor goes down, then Lightning nodes that are using Tor addresses can't be reached.
I appreciate you expanding on that.
Yeah. I don't know more about that attack. I've heard a little bit, but really I'm just parroting my high level understanding of stuff.
Right. So the next question I have is around, so just thinking about you, so you're obviously a very technical individual. You're obviously very focused on working on what you're working on, which is DLCs and oracles and adapter signatures and everything we talked about. But whenever you're thinking just as a technologist, what are some of the other things that are happening around that are in this realm of innovation happening around Bitcoin specifically related to types of contracts, like with projects like is RSK interesting to you? Are colored coins, is the RGB project, is that interesting to you like at all? And if so, how do you like sort of think about it? Like how do they work in parallel with each other?
Yeah, good question. I think RGB is certainly interesting. I only know super high level stuff. I don't know how RGB actually accomplishes its kind of goals in terms of like how it builds single use seals and stuff like that. But should RGB work? I mean, it would be pretty cool. you know, I think that a lot of people have some pushback against things like RGB or colored coins because, you know, it clogs up the blockchain, say, as one argument where you're using it for something other than Bitcoin. Like, you could imagine, like, using it for like a Bitcoin transaction, which actually transacts Tether or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And it could lead to shitcoining, like, essentially created on top of Bitcoin, too. Yeah. I'm not really interested in that as well. So I'm more so just, like, does some of these other projects just, from a high level, do they expand in a way on the functionality of DLCs and oracles?
Yes. So actually, on the point of RGB, so I'm actually not too worried about them clogging up the blockchain because they'll have to pay for it. Like, they still have to pay fees. You know, there are, I mean, unless people are worried that, like, all of the assets that'll end up on Bitcoin will, like, outvalue Bitcoin itself or something weird like that, where, you know, people have talked about the weird incentive problems that might cause for miners and things like this. I don't think that's an issue. And more than that, you know, RGB is entirely compatible with DLCs. You can have DLCs that are collateralized, say, by one side using Bitcoin and the other side using Tether or something weird like that. And it's, well, I guess, again, I don't know too much about the technicals of RGB, but I've heard claims that it's even, you can do that on Lightning. Like, you can have RGB payments that happen over Lightning.
Yeah, well, you know what we need to do? You know what we need to do, man? We need to get somebody from one of those projects and get you guys both on here at the same time.
Yeah,
and get basically two SMEs from, you know, from the different sides of the ring, and maybe, you know, a third project in there too, and just talk about how all of these things interact. Totally. And, you know, yeah, I can just sit back and listen and maybe try to moderate and just let you guys talk, and, like, because you're kind of speaking in something I can tell that's a little bit out of your element because you're not working on those projects specifically. So are you in contact with any of those, you know, maybe from a developer from one of those projects that we could get?
Yeah, I mean, I know some of the people who are working on RGB, and I would say, RGB is something of a special case where I know less about RGB than I know about other contracting proposals, in part because I know that they've been super busy trying to get, you know, stuff operational as soon as possible. And they've kind of bit off a ton of work. Like, they're building nodes from scratch. It's kind of crazy. But I know that a lot of that stuff is going to be interoperable with a lot of other stuff, even not just RGB, but, like, the node that they're building is going to be useful in the future, potentially for DLCs and stuff like that. But because they're so busy, you know, I haven't seen as many high level docs pop out. They're usually more like, you know, a code and things like that, which I don't have time to look over. But yeah, I mean, that could be super cool. But yeah, I guess most of my hesitancy around making claims about RGB is because I haven't gotten the time to dig in as deeply as needed. But I can certainly speak to other projects as well. I know that there are people working on CoinSwaps, for example. CoinSwaps are super cool. I'm trying to think, is there integration between DLCs and CoinSwaps? I think you could probably do it. I'm not sure it would be worth the while. So I guess, there's some cool things you can do with DLCs. And for example, if you put a bunch of people who are executing DLCs with each other, you can kind of do a coin join out of that, where you, like, instead of having a 2-of-2 funding transaction, you could have all of these different people who have set up contracts with one another. You could have them all come together, build one giant N-of-N transaction where, you know, they have all the proper adapter signatures so that when the Oracle broadcasts, you know, their signatures, then any one person can execute that entire N of N and have all the payouts go out to all the people. And with this, you can actually even introduce some more, like, some capital efficiency tricks where, like, say I take out one position against you and one position against someone else, and those aren't exactly, you know, there's some overlap there. Like, I say I took your position against them. We could do some, like, netting where, like, you know, I get to, like, reduce my amount of collateral and I put you and the other person who I was communicating with against each other in this thing, right? Because it's just one big pool of money. So there's no need for anyone to be over collateralized. And on top of that, it's a coin join. And it looks just like a coin join, and you can't tell. Well, maybe you can tell because the output values aren't fixed numbers or anything. But yeah, so one nice thing about kind of all of these schemes is if you want to build an interesting contracting scheme on top of Bitcoin, you're restricted to some very small set of lower level, like on-chain tools. And because that set is so minimal, right, at the end of the day, it's usually just you've got transactions, meaning, you know, you have inputs and outputs and transactions that can spend from one another. You have signatures, multi-signatures, and I guess you have time locks and hash locks, say. And, you know, you have adapter signatures and stuff that you can do off-chain. You could call those point locks if you wanted. And then everything is built from that, right? So like a DLC, you've got a bunch of transactions that have point locks on them. CoinJoin, it's just you've got one very large transaction. Coin swaps, you've got two different transactions that have point locks that they each have a point lock, and those point locks are related by some off-chain secret. And also keep in mind, when I say a point lock, I mean like an adapter signature is used. So that's not actually an on-chain footprint of any kind, which is neat. But you could use a hash lock, and that would be an on-chain footprint, and it would accomplish more or less the same thing. Or not the same thing, but something similar. Yeah, so I guess at a high level, since all of these things are just using this very limited toolbox, they end up pretty much using the same toolbox, and that's part of why they're so interoperable. Like, you know, you can put DLCs on Lightning. You could, you know, mix DLCs with coin joins. You could do all sorts of kind of these kinds of things. You could do a coin swap for like, I guess this is called a submarine swap, where you like have a Lightning payment that's atomic with an on-chain payment, in a kind of coin swap fashion.
It's going to be so interesting in a couple years when all of these proposals are actually like implemented at the same time, and all of this has been now abstracted away from, you know, from the user, and it's just built native into every wallet. It's going to be really, really cool what you can do.
Especially with Taproot, because like then everything, not only can you interop everything, but it'll be all hidden, and you know, you'll be minimal on-chain fees.
And it's literally going to be like a little button, and you're not going to have to think about anything. And what it's going to enable you to do is going to be just fascinating.
Totally.
This has been an awesome conversation. I've enjoyed this one a lot.
Yeah. And I guess, yeah, I'm trying to think if there are any other contracting proposals out there that are on my, I guess one of them that I always like to bring up is it's called Smart Contracts Unchained. I don't think there's anyone working on it. It was posted like well over a year ago at this point. It's essentially a way to do, I like to think of it as a way to enable oblivious escrow contracts, where you have a model that's a little bit similar to the DLC Oracle model, but for escrows. So it's not exactly the same. There's some trade-offs. What you get is like arbitrary functionality instead of just contingent on some data. And what you give up is in non-cooperative cases, there's a little bit of a privacy, or you have to actually interact with the escrow, I guess is what I'm trying to say. If you build it well, I guess I should say what it actually is. So say you and me want to, I can't think of any not too complicated examples, so I'll keep it abstract. Say you and me have some pretty complicated contract with a bunch of logic in it, including like some computation even. Like say, you know, people always talk about like, you can't do Turing complete things. Well, here's how you do it. We have some arbitrary contracts that you and me have agreed to. Essentially what that means is we have a program written in whatever, say like it's written in C# or Go or, you know, some programming language, pick your favorite. And, you know, we give it some inputs, say those inputs could include, they could be like DLC Oracle signatures as inputs, for example, like, you know, some data about the real world or something that happened or something like this. Or it could involve like, it could be just the actual data. instead of signatures from oracles, but then the escrow would have to validate that. So I guess to keep things super simple, say you give it some oracle signatures, which corresponds to what actually happened, and then you run that through this program, and then at the other end of the program, you know, some arbitrarily complicated computation happened, and at the other end of the program, we've got who gets what money, essentially, right? So we lock up funds into this. We want to lock up funds into this contract, but you know, with Bitcoin, you only have so many tools. But it turns out all you really need is multisig. So here's why: we write this contract in whatever language we want. You know, you could use Solidity if you wanted, but that's not a very nicely typed language. You should probably use something nicer, you know, Rust or Scala or something like that. And then we both agree to it, so we both sign it. Now we put our funds into, to keep things simple, let's say a 2 of 3 multisig, where the first key is yours, second key is mine, third key is a tweaked version of the escrow. So the escrow is just this third party that's going to execute in cases of dispute. So we don't use their actual key, but we tweak their key using like the hash of our contract or something like that. So that they can't look on chain and see that they're being used. It's just some random looking key. And then once we have that done, we wait, say all of the data that we needed or anything we needed has happened. Then we go to one another and we're like, okay, I ran the program. Here's what I get. Here's what you get. If we both agree, good to go. It's 2 of 3 multisig. We each sign. That's 2 signatures. We're good to go. And keep in mind, 2 of 3 multisig still, right, it'll look like a single pub key on chain under Taproot, where the key that goes on chain is the two of us, our aggregate key. So we can just sign that away. And then in cases of dispute, we'll go down to the script, down the mast to some 2 of 2, either you and the Oracle or me and the Oracle. Not the Oracle, sorry, you and the escrow or me and the escrow. And then, so say we agree, then it looks like a normal single pub key spent. And we just executed an arbitrarily complex contract on Bitcoin with no on-chain footprint other than just like a DLC. Money got put in, money got sent out, according to this contract, but you don't see the contract. And you can't tell that there was one either. And it looks like single pub key spends. So, you know, everything you want. Now, if there is a disagreement, then either one of us can go to this escrow, the trusted party who's running, like, say, a VM. We give them the program. We give them the signatures that we each had of the hash of the program. They run the program on the inputs. They come out with the output. They sign that transaction, right? The output is just a transaction. They sign it. And then me and the escrow, or you and the escrow, can then execute, because, right, it's a 2 of 3. And yeah, so as I mentioned, this is a bit of a simplification. In reality, you want to use more than one escrow, right? You'll make this not just a 2 of 3, but a larger scheme where it's either just the two of us, or it's me and 3 of 5 escrows, or you and 3 of 5 escrows, or something like this. But then on chain, all it looks like is, in the case of cooperation, which is most of the time, you know, you and me will just sign from the top, you know, the 2 of 2 between us, which is just a single key, and spend the money as it should be. Or in the case that there's a disagreement, either one of us can go get some number of or escrows to run this program. So essentially all these escrows are doing is they're obliviously, like, they get a bunch of data, they run a program, and then they spit out a signature. And that's all they do. Like, they don't need to know what actually the program logic is. You can do all sorts of things to, like, hide it, right? You could do masked kinds of things like we do in Taproot, where you only reveal, like, the spending branch you're using, and where, but this is all off-chain, and where rather than giving them actual data, you just give them signatures, or tweaked signatures even, so they can't even tell what this data corresponds to or what you're speculating on. Or anything like that. So at the end of the day, you want these escrows to be super oblivious. You're using many of them. All they do, it's, again, relatively low cost. They're probably just running some VM on a server somewhere, and that VM just executes programs as they come in. Yeah, and if you have this, then you can execute arbitrary contracts on Bitcoin with minimal on-chain footprint, just to, like, 2 transactions, just like a DLC. where it's entirely private in the case of cooperation, and the only person who learns the tiniest amount is the escrows when they're contacted in cases of dispute. And so kind of this has two nice properties. One is like, you can do anything you want with Bitcoin, and you can even like, you can take this stuff, put it on Lightning. You can take this stuff, put it anywhere, just like you can DLCs, right? Same on chain footprint. It has this nice property, I think, of, so if you look at like Ethereum or some other blockchain where people are executing contracts, like contract logic on chain, I always find that a little baffling that that's like the go-to thing, because it's like, I guess in most cases of people doing things in the real world, like they are cooperative, right? In the case of cooperation, there is no reason to be using a blockchain when people are being cooperative. It's like going to the grocery store, like fully loaded and like with a bulldozer or a tank or something, and be like, I demand you sell me groceries. And they're like, yeah, we want to, like, come out of there. What are you doing? Right? Like, you don't need the heavy machinery in order to execute 99% of contracts.
Right.
Right. And that's what happens in this scheme, right? In 99% of contracts, you're just going to have like single pub key spends, sending things around, no scripts revealed anywhere. But at the end of the day, like the underlying thing, the thing you're committed to, is an arbitrarily complex contract that you've both agreed to. But where you don't use the blockchain to enforce that contract, right? You use just cooperation almost all the time. And then you only use the blockchain in cases of dispute. And you also, in that case, use it minimally, right? You do all the computation off-chain, or you have some other parties do all the computation off-chain. It takes just a sprinkling of trust, but you're already trusting a little bit because the blockchain doesn't know anything about the real world. You need a little bit of trust in some like smart way. You want to be able to disperse that trust, mitigate against any risk that that trust brings on, right? Those are all the things you need to do. That's what a solution to the Oracle, or an answer to the Oracle problem is it's how do you mitigate Oracle risk? And then once you have any solution to the Oracle problem, then you can do anything you want, right? And most of the time, you won't even need to use that stuff. But in the times that you do, you have that computation be done off-chain, and you just use the chain as a way to bypass the need for cooperation between two parties. Even though most of the time they cooperate. Yeah.
I think that was a beautiful way to tie it all together at the end.
Totally.
I do want to be cognizant, because this is really deep for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And we're at an hour and a half now. I feel like some people that are, you know, trying to listen to this, they're thinking through it. Like, they have to be like pretty much thinking. So I want to be cognizant to like wrap right here, just so we're giving people a mental break. And then I really do like the idea of getting you on here with some other people and, you know, explore and like kind of have me as just like sit back and, you know, let you guys kind of explore it from your both of your perspectives, or maybe there's multiple people. So I'm down for that. Let's work it out. Totally. I really appreciate you coming on. Go ahead and give your shill again, and where people can find you and all of that.
Yeah. So, first of all, you know, if you're thinking about all this stuff, that's awesome. And if you want to read more about it, pretty much everything I've talked about, I've also written about over at shredbits.com/blog. I have authored a lot of blog posts over there about all these things, like I mentioned, PTLCs, DLCs, Schnorr signatures, all that stuff on there. Post there somewhat regularly. If you want to reach me, I am at Nadav_Cohen with a K. So that's NADAV_KOHEN on Twitter. Nadav@shredbits.com email.
Awesome, man. It was great conversation today, and I really enjoyed it. And keep doing what you're doing. Sure. Everybody in the Bitcoin space appreciates it.
And it's going to be a big year.
It is. 2021 is I think every year is going just continually gets better and better for Bitcoin. So yeah. I'm super bullish.
Sure thing. Me too.
All right, man. Thanks.
Yeah.